This morning, we're dealing with successful secession movements. Our mission, Frontline Fellowship, I've been a missionary for almost as long as Des Palm's been involved in business, 40 years in missions, and I've been an eyewitness to a number of successful secession movements. And after tea, I'll share about some in history as well. Our mission exists to serve persecuted churches and restricted access areas throughout Africa. I've traveled in 42 countries. I've been involved in 3 revolutions. I've been through 8 wars, and I've worked in 38 countries. As a missionary for 38 years has concentrated in serving persecuted Christians and restricted access areas, I've traveled in 42 countries, worked in 38 countries across 4 continents, and this included throughout Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. The Iron Curtain was the great reality of the first half of my life. I never imagined in my lifetime the Iron Curtain would come down or the captive nations behind the Iron Curtain would go free. I went to the Iron Curtain. I smuggled Bibles behind the Iron Curtain. I knew and have many friends who were brought up under the oppression of the Soviet Union, where people fled by the millions across the greatest obstacle course ever known to man, the Iron Curtain. It took 3 to 5 hours to go through a border post into Eastern Europe. On average, 3 to 5 hours. Queues. And the idol worship, the hero worship, the Caesar worship of the dictator, just like Ceausescu in Romania, they composed thousands of hymns, 8,000 hymns of praise to Ceausescu, which the children had to sing at school and praise the political leader. They'd have these idolatrous processions on May Day, 1st of May. Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, Karl Marx. And notice, not just the flags of communist countries, the flags of every country. You can see quite a few countries there whose flags are there, not communist. They were claiming them all for Marxism. You have a world to win, they said. On the 1st of May, we'd see even the countries that were meant to be enemies were actually united. They said that China and Russia were enemies. Well, not on May Day, it seemed. It seemed that North Korea was not a part of the same bloc, but there they are. Yugoslavia, they meant to be part of the non-aligned group of nations. In fact, they were as communist as the rest. Yugoslavia under Tito, one-party state. Albania, the most atheistic country on the planet. They killed every minister, every imam. There wasn't one single church, mosque in the whole country. They killed them all, destroyed them all. The destructive legacy of Versailles created countries that were not nations, like Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, which never existed before the vindictive Versailles Treaty, and they don't exist today either. These were bad ideas from the beginning. And free and independent nations have broken away from these empires of Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia. Yugoslavia, meaning the land of the South Slavs, included Slovenia and Croatia, who were definitely not Slavic. They were formerly part of the Austrian Empire with the Germanic language and the Germanic culture. However, the fragile political entity called Yugoslavia was composed of 6 republics, 5 nationalities, 4 languages, 3 major religions, 2 alphabets, but only 1 political party, the Communist Party, from 1945 to 1989. Another kaleidoscope nation, you can't call kaleidoscope nation, nations actually just a country or an empire, created by the Versailles Treaty was Czechoslovakia, which didn't survive long after the fall of the Iron Curtain and the withdrawal of the Soviet Red Army of occupation. When I first visited Yugoslavia, smuggling Bibles behind the Iron Curtain, I heard the people in Croatia speaking about the need for independence. I was highly skeptical. I thought, these people, you know, might as well talk about going landing on Mars. Independence? From Yugoslavia behind the Iron Curtain? How would this be possible? And yet, this was the reality when I went in. The Red Star. That was the reality. Communism. You had no freedom of speech, no freedom of religion. In 1990, though, the first multi-party elections were held in Croatia. And on the 25th of June, 1991, Croatia declared independence. which came into effect 8 October 1991. By 15 January 1992, Croatia was recognized as an independent country by the European Economic Community. First country to recognize them was Germany, who then persuaded the rest of the EU to accept their independence. Beautiful country, great history, great heritage. But Yugoslavia invaded, and this aggression by Yugoslavia was ended effectively August 1995 with a decisive victory by Croatia. And since then, 5 August has been a public holiday, a victory and homeland Thanksgiving Day. Slovenia. A group of intellectuals articulate the case for Slovene independence as early as 1987 in the magazine Nova Revizija. And the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights was formed. And demands for democratization and independence for Slovenia forced the communist government to enact a number of democratic reforms. In September 1989, this is just before the Berlin Wall came down, amendments were passed to introduce parliamentary democracy to Slovenia. On the 7th of March 1990, the Slovenian Assembly changed the official name of the state to the Republic of Slovenia. In April 1990, the first democratic elections in Slovenia took place. On the 23rd of December 1990, your mind races with how fast this actually happened in the end. More than 88% of the electorate voted in a referendum for sovereign independent Slovenia. Slovenia declared its independence 25 June 1991. Just about 3 years after I'd heard them talking about it, when it looked like as remote as man living on Mars. The Yugoslav People's Army, so-called, invaded on the 27th of June 1991, and this resulted in what has been called the 10-day war. And the result was the Brijuni Agreement and the withdrawal of the Yugoslav Army from Slovenia. December 1991, a new constitution was adopted, followed by laws on denationalization, privatization of all state enterprise by 1992. This is just mind-boggling how fast this moved. The members of the European Union recognized Slovenia as an independent state on the 15th of January 1992, at just 5 years after the initial suggestions of independence was actually raised under communism, when the Soviet Union was still the ruling entity and when the Iron Curtain was still up. And today, there are 6 different countries where there was one political party and an empire called Yugoslavia. And so Yugoslavia today looks very different from when I first visited it. When I first traveled to Bratislava in Czechoslovakia, talk of the Slovakians seceding from Czechoslovakia seemed unrealistic and frankly impossible. The reality was the Berlin Wall, the Iron Curtain, every attempt to rebel against and rise up and show resistance to communism had been put down in bloody purges. 1956 in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, the invasion of the Soviets. This is not the Second World War. This is 1968, the devastation caused by the Red Army in downtown Prague. Absolutely horrific. Czechoslovakia rose up again under the Soviet tanks invading them in 1968. Absolutely horrific. The entire Warsaw Pact invaded Czechoslovakia and crushed their attempts to introduce some democratization of what they called communism with a human face. Not acceptable. Here's my father-in-law, Bill Bathman, by the Red Star, smuggling Bibles. He was working throughout these areas throughout the time. When I was married, I went on a Bible smuggling operation with my new bride, with my parents-in-law, 2 different vehicles, smuggling behind Iron Curtain from Czechoslovakia all the way down to Yugoslavia and Romania. The Christians were adamant that Slovakia must become an independent country. Czech, Slovakia, 2 different countries. Why did they make them into one? Indeed, following the collapse of communist rule in Czechoslovakia in 1989 and the withdrawal of the Soviet Red Army, the Czech-Slovak Socialist Republic was renamed the Slovak Republic. And the Christians are adamant that this country must become free and independent. On 17th of July 1991, Slovakia declared itself a sovereign state, meaning that its laws took precedence over those of the federal government. And throughout the autumn of 1992, negotiations with the Czech federal government resulted in the vote on the 31st of December 1992 to dissolve Czechoslovakia. And the Slovak Republic and the Czech Republic went their separate ways from 1st of January 1993. And that was after a referendum. Peaceful. No lives lost at all. After the overthrow of communist rule in Czechoslovakia had been called the Velvet Revolution, because there'd been no loss of life. It was done peacefully. The age of war over secession had ended, and now it was being done peacefully. So the secession of Czech and Slovakia was called the Velvet Divorce. Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia are three Baltic states down the Baltic coast, on the Baltic Sea, which were occupied over the centuries by Sweden, Poland, and Russia. The Republic of Latvia was established 18th of November 1918, when it seceded from the Soviet Union after the Bolshevik Revolution said, we want nothing to do this. They made themselves an independent country. In 1940, Latvia was invaded by the Soviet Union. Later, Latvia was liberated by the German forces during Operation Barbarossa in 1941. And in 1944, the Soviet Red Army again invaded Latvia and forced it back into the Soviet Union. Starting in 1987, the Singing Revolution called for Baltic emancipation, liberation from communist and Soviet occupation. They called it the Singing Revolution. You can actually see the film on YouTube, because they had no other way of resisting. They had no power, no political rights, no freedom of speech, so they gathered for cultural events and just sang. And they sang of their culture, and they sang of their freedoms, and they sang of the past, and they sang of their history and of their people. And this was resistance to communism, but it was done in the form of song. On the 4th of May 1990, the Declaration of the Restoration of Independence of the Republic of Latvia was issued, and on the 21st of August 1991, Latvia declared its independence. Latvia has been declared the capital of culture in the European Union. And its capital, Riga, has hosted the Choir Olympics, which my daughter Daniela, as part of the Cape Town Youth Choir, participated in. And you'd be interested to know that on the classical music, the University of Stellenbosch's choir won worldwide. Over 140 choirs from around the world gathered in Riga for this event. A spectacular event. A country that won its independence through song now celebrates culture. Estonia was also occupied over the centuries by the Polish, the Swedish, and the Russian forces and declared its independence 24th of February 1918. On the 6th of August 1940, Estonia was invaded and occupied by Stalin's Soviet Red Army and incorporated in the Soviet Union. Estonians continued to resist the Soviet occupation for years after the Second World War. In fact, 5 years after the Second World War, 1950, they were still fighting. The Soviet Union was the enemy, and the Forest Brothers resistance movement opposed the collectivization where people were taken off their own farms and forced into barracks to work a state farm, and the forced removals where many millions of the people were shipped off to the Siberian wastelands, and their areas were invaded by Russians to try and depopulate the Estonians out of their own area. And these are some of the resistance fighters who were fighting as late as 1950, 5 years after the war. And they told me, we were waiting for the Americans to come and free us. Poor people. They thought the Americans and the British cared about their freedom. But maybe they'd watched Hollywood movies and thought that this was actually reality. And here you can see this chap's a falconer. He's got his two falcons on his shoulders. He could teach these to attack, and he would have these falcons fly into the face of the Red Army and put their talons into the face, enable him to get an advantage. In 1987, a singing revolution began in Estonia as well, but 1988, the Popular Front of Estonia became the standard bearer for Estonian independence. The Estonian National Independence Party was the first non-communist party in the Soviet Union. It demanded full restoration of independence. So before any other group of 127 language groups in the Soviet Union, the Estonians were the first to call for independence. The first party aside from the Communist Party. As they declared, Estonia never joined the Soviet Union. This reminds me. The Cape was never given a choice or a referendum on whether we wanted to join the Union of South Africa. The Cape was an entity long before there was any habitation in Joburg or Pretoria. We had our own parliament meeting before there was even a Pandoki in what today is called Johannesburg or Pretoria. On the 16th of November 1988, the Estonian Supreme Soviet issued a sovereignty declaration asserting the primacy of Estonian laws over Soviet Union laws. Very brave when the reality is the KGB. On the 23rd of August 1989, the Estonians, Latvians and Lithuanians united in a human chain, a life chain, a Baltic Way human chain, they call it, where 2 million people spread across the main road stretching across Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia in a continuous chain of protest as they sang for independence, declaring and demanding the need to restore their independence. You can see the types of cars of the time. It may look to you a bit older than that, but remember they were way behind the times in the Soviet Union. Resistance. 1990, the Congress of Estonia was formed as a representative body of Estonian citizens. In March 1991, a referendum was held where 77% of the voters supported independence. I think you can see a common theme here. Referendums. A Moscow coup attempt was exposed and resisted, and Estonia declared its restoration of independence 20 August 1990, which is now observed as national holiday in Estonia. Now, in all these cases in Europe, I think you'll admit the progress was startlingly fast. Some people say, you know, it'll take decades and so on. Well, it depends on the will of the people. It depends on if the people believe strongly in this and mobilize enough, it can happen fast. The last units of the Red Army left Estonia in 1994. And in 1992, Estonia launched economic reforms for privatization, free market economy. This is one thing we see continually. Whenever countries go for independence and secession, they tend to choose privatization, decentralization, because they know what oppression comes from totalitarian, top-down, centralized structures. In 2004, Estonia joined European Union and NATO. Doubtless, they felt vulnerable with a hulking great big Russian Federation next to them, and so this was maybe an attempt for extra protection. Lovely people. My daughters sung with these people, got many friends amongst them. Estonia won their freedoms through song. The last of the Baltic states of Lithuania seceded from the Soviet Union, also in 1918, 16 February, to form the Republic of Lithuania. 1940, Lithuania was invaded and occupied by the Soviet Red Army. 11th of March 1990, a year before the formal dissolution of the Soviet Union, Lithuania became the first Baltic state to officially declare itself independent. And so, Lithuania led the charge. Now, you may ask, well, why didn't these three Baltic states become the same? They're very similar, but they have their own cultures, and they support one another. They're good neighbors. Again, some people may think, why don't we do this together with the Northern Cape and with the East Cape? Well, in time that may happen, but you start where you are, and you can be good neighbors. And what are you told on an aircraft when there's depressurization? First, put the mask on your own self before attempting to help other passengers. Why? You can't help others if you've passed out. We'd be in a better position to help our neighbors with our independence than we would without. On 11th of March 1990, the Supreme Council announced the restoration of Lithuania's independence, but it wasn't easy. 28th of March 1990, the Soviet Union imposed an economic blockade in Lithuania. It lasted 74 days, but Lithuania stood firm and did not budge. Then the Soviet Union attempted a coup in Lithuania, storming the Seimas Palace, and Lithuanians vigorously defended the council and inspired other Soviet republics to secede from the Union. Shortly after that, 11th of February 1991, the first overseas country to recognize independence was Iceland. In fact, Iceland said, we never rescinded our first recognition of Lithuania's independence in 1922. It's still in effect because we never recognized the illegal Soviet invasion and suppression of them anyway. So with Iceland having recognized them, the way was open, and soon full diplomatic relations were reestablished with all of the European countries. On the 25th of October 1992, the Lithuanian citizens voted in a referendum to adopt the new constitution. Only next year did the Red Army finally leave. 31 August 1903, the last units of the Soviet Army withdrew from Lithuanian territory. And since 2004, Lithuania has become a member of NATO and the European Union and a strong, independent country. And you can see these countries have a history, they have a heritage, they have a right to be free and independent. And if they could achieve their independence, why can we in the Cape not do so? Free the Cape, Cape exit. I was asked some time ago, what are the moral, ethical, philosophical justifications, foundations for secession? Well, let me start off with secessions in the Bible and secessions in history, and I'll end up with African success stories in secession, because I had someone come and say, you've just given a whole lot of good examples of secession in Europe. Has it ever happened in Africa? Yes, it has, and I was part of it, and that's where I want to end up. But let's start in the Bible. Almost everyone remembers Exodus. Maybe you've seen the film The Ten Commandments, one of the best films ever made of Charlton Heston. And you all remember the great refrain, let my people go. That was the refrain in South Sudan. So Moses and Aaron came into Pharaoh and said to him, thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go, that they may serve me. The nation of Israel grew out of secession from Egypt. Fact. In the Bible, a nation is an ethno-linguistic people group with a shared faith. The scriptures make it clear the Hebrews remained Hebrews even after 480 years in Egypt. They never became Egyptians. We are not geographic accidents, we're demographic descendants. I mean, if you were born on board ship, somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic, what nationality are you? What nationality are your parents, obviously? It's the way they've now made it, you know, if you're born in an aircraft or something, it's not where you're born, it's your parents, it's your lineage, it's your family, it's your community. These are the things that matter. In 1 Kings 12, we read of the secession of the 10 northern tribes from the United Kingdom of Israel. After the reigns of King Saul, King David, and King Solomon, they were the first three kings of a united Israel. The United Kingdom was divided when Solomon's son Rehoboam foolishly dismissed the wise counsel of the elders who had stood before his father Solomon. Instead, Rehoboam chose to rather listen to the irresponsible advice of the young men who had grown up with him, instead of sharing of wisdom, sharing of ignorance. As a result, he arrogantly dismissed the petition of his subjects and threatened to tax them even heavier and to burden them with even more oppressive laws than they'd ever experienced before under their father Solomon. Now, when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king saying, what share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, O David. So Israel departed to their tents. So Israel has been rebelling against the house of David. There was none who followed the house of David but the tribe of Judah only, later Benjamin. When King Rehoboam assembled 180,000 soldiers to fight against the house of Israel to restore the United Kingdom, God stopped them, declaring this secession was of him. But the word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, the man of God, saying, speak to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, to all the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, saying, thus says the Lord, you shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Let every man return to his house, for this thing is from me. What thing? Secession. This secession, splitting the United Kingdom of Israel into the Northern Kingdom of Israel and the Southern Kingdom of Judah, this is of me. Therefore they obeyed the word of the Lord and turned back according to the word of the Lord, and there was no civil war. The scripture emphasized that all the families of the nations of the earth are to sing the praise of the Creator in every language and tongue. It's interesting that when you go into Revelation 5, you see in heaven, you're still identified as parts of nations and tribes and languages and people groups. And they sang a new song saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open the seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. So your tribe and tongue and people and nation is significant, even in eternity. A nation is an ethno-linguistic people group with a shared faith. Unfortunately, many today are confused about the concept of a nation. This could be because there's a group of state representatives in New York calling themselves the United Nations. Of course, most of them have no legitimacy at all. The United Nations is the largest collection of unelected dictators, mass murderers, drug traffickers, human traffickers on the planet. Most of them are actually just gangsters with flags. Now, the United States deludes itself that it is one nation, under God, indivisible. Why 50 states in a voluntary union should be considered indivisible seems incomprehensible to most of us. Yet Americans are expected to make this pledge on a regular basis. I praise God we don't make this kind of pledge in our country. Abraham Lincoln waged a ruinous war in which over 650,000 people died to preserve the union of what was meant to be a confederation. Before this time, they called it the United States of America R. After this became the United States of America IS. And since that war between the states concluded in 1865, America has become more and more centralized, with central government overruling state governments on such matters as abortion and state-mandated education. And the states are telling local states, no, no, you can't ban abortion in your state. No, you can't do this kind of education. No, you can't teach intelligence design. You've got to teach evolution. No, you've got to have sex education. Central government telling states like Georgia and Tennessee and Iowa what they must do. When the Soviet Union, the USSR, broke up, this was considered a good thing. There was a lot of rejoicing in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Ukraine, Belarus, Armenia, Georgia, and many others seceded from the Soviet Union. Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Azerbaijan, Armenia. It was a good thing for freedom that the Soviet Union was not indivisible. In fact, there's 127 language groups in the Soviet Union. It's the largest continuous empire in the world. It stretches across two continents, from Europe to Asia, from the Arctic Sea all the way through to the Pacific Ocean, to the Black Sea. Unbelievable. They've got so many different tribes and nations. They've even got a tribe of astronauts, according to National Geographic. But today, there are 15 different republics where there used to be one. And who knows how many parties where there used to be only one party. So it's a good thing for freedom and for independence that the Soviet Union was not indivisible. Now, what about successful secessions in history? Can it work? Well, some of the most successful countries on the planet are the results of secession. Take Switzerland, which seceded from Austria in 1291. Inspired by the courage of expert marksman William Tell, who refused to bow before the hat of Albert Gessler, raised on a pole in the market square of Adeldorf, where he was meant to bow. When William Tell refused to bow to this cap, Gessler's cruel wrath, mixed with a curiosity to test William Tell's legendary marksmanship with his crossbow, commanded him to shoot an apple off his son's head with a crossbow bolt. Imagine the sadisticness of a man who could order that. And William Tell had such confidence in his accuracy that he did just that. And when William Tell succeeded in splitting an apple with his arrow, saving the life of both his son and himself, Gessler asked, "Why have you ready two arrows?" William Tell said, "If he had missed with the first, he would not have missed with the second in Gessler's heart." This was considered seditious. And enraged, Gessler had William Tell arrested and taken by boat across Lake Luzerne to Küsnacht to spend the rest of his life in a dungeon. Well, a fierce storm enabled William Tell to escape to shore, where he later ambushed and killed Gessler with an arrow, launching the young Confederacy's secession from Austrian rule. The first three cantons formed the Swiss Confederacy in 1291, with Schweiz, Uri, and Unterwalden. Switzerland's the oldest republic in the world, now consisting of 26 cantons. Now, I've had people say in America, "America's the oldest republic in the world." And I say, "Have you never heard of Switzerland?" I've heard people in America saying, America's the freest country that ever was. Have you never heard of Switzerland? They've got a lot more freedom than you've got. Despite Switzerland occupying the crossroads of Germanic and Romanish Europe, as reflected in the form of its linguistic and cultural regions, they've got German, French, Italian, and Romance, its confederal, decentralized, direct democracy policy of armed neutrality enabled Switzerland to stay out of the ruinous world wars. Led by Prince William of Orange, the Netherlands seceded from Spain beginning in 1568. The reason why we have an orange river and an orange free state and the old South African flag had an orange instead of a red stripe is because of the Prince of Orange, the father of Dutch liberties. How many people remember that Holland was once a colony of Spain? The United States of America as a result of secession. The USA seceded from Great Britain in 1776, demanding their chartered rights as Englishmen under Magna Carta, the Great Charter of 1215. The 13 colonies constituted themselves as the United States of America with a Declaration of Independence, 4 July 1776. So you can sometimes ask Americans, what do they think they are celebrating on the 4th of July? And many of them have forgotten, I think. They maintained that as the English government had failed to protect them and provide for their rights, as guaranteed by Magna Carta 1215, they were absolved of any allegiance to the British government in London. You see, government is a contract. As they demand our allegiance and taxes and so on, they must provide in return protection and services. And if they fail on their side, then our side of the bargain is abrogated. And this is how the United States, remember, just started on their east coast. They later purchased a huge area from the French, and then they took a whole lot more from the Spanish. Belgium seceded from the Netherlands in 1830. In fact, I was intrigued when I went to Belgium to find that I could understand them easier than even the Netherlands people, because Flanders is closer to Afrikaans than Netherlands. And of course, we forget. I often wonder if Afrikaans isn't Africa Flanders, because the Flemish language is very close to Afrikaans. Or should I say Afrikaans is very close to Flemish? Flemish came first. But remember that the Netherlands originally included what today is called Belgium. They seceded in 1830. Texas seceded from Mexico in 1836. We all remember the Alamo. The Battle of the Alamo was a pivotal event in the independence for Texas. And the cruelty and arbitrary lawlessness of President Antonio López de Santa Anna. I wondered why we've got a Santa Anna spur. I mean, don't they know what Santa Anna did? He's not one good man. Led other Texans to rise up and defeat the Mexican army in the Battle of San Jacinto, securing the independence of Texas from Mexico. Texas seceded from Mexico in 1836. And they've got written into the Constitution their right to secede from America anytime too. Nicaragua seceded from Guatemala in 1838. And Norway seceded from Sweden in 1905. That's not that long ago. That's in my grandfather's lifetime. That Norway seceded from Sweden. Prince Carl of Denmark was unanimously elected king by the Norwegian Parliament, the first king of a fully independent Norway in 508 years. He took the name Håkon the Seventh. A national referendum confirmed the people's preference for a monarchy over a republic. It's a constitutional monarchy. And the peaceful separation of Norway from Sweden was effected 7th of June 1905. Very nice that the Vikings could part amicably without a lot of shedding of blood, but it was done. Finland seceded from Russia in 1917. I noticed our friends in Finland celebrating the centenary of independence just a few years ago. So, interesting. They used to be part of the Russian Empire. In reaction to the Bolshevik Revolution, which was tearing Russia apart, the Finns set up their own parliament, which declared independence from the chaos of Russia, 6th of December, 1917. Have you noticed how the Vikings have the cross in all their flags, now the most bloodthirsty people the world had ever seen, the first marines, the first seaborne invaders? They all have a cross in their flags, indicating they all got converted, and they have secession and independence. And there was a time that Iceland was a colony of Denmark, and when Norway was a colony of Sweden, and there's a lot of these areas which now you can see have their own independence recognized. The Republic of Ireland seceded from Great Britain in 1922. We're just a year and a half away from Ireland celebrating the centenary of their independence. And again, many people would have said that was not possible. But it happened after centuries of war and violence between the Irish and the English. Ireland's finally separate independent republic. Pakistan seceded from India in 1947. This was not a nice secession. It was quite violent. And later, Pakistan seceded from India. But notice, you had Pakistan, West Pakistan, and Pakistan, East Pakistan. East Pakistan later seceded from Pakistan in 1971. So Bangladesh is now recognized as an independent country after initially being one country in two sections. Taiwan, Free China, separated from Red China in 1949 and is one of the most successful economies in Asia. In fact, I've had quite a number of Bibles and books printed in Taiwan because Taipei can print better and cheaper than anywhere in Africa, even counting in the cost of shipping it over to us by sea. Singapore seceded from Malaysia in 1965. Now, Malaya had become independent from Britain in 1957, became Malaysia in 1961. It went incorporated Sarawak and Singapore. But Singapore then peacefully seceded after referendum in 1965. And Singapore has turned an unpromising island swamp into one of the most potent economic powerhouses in all of Asia. And my wife's been to Singapore representing cancer survivor Dragon Boaters over there, and she says, what a clean, neat, well-run, powerful economy. It used to just be a malarial swamp. It's incredible what good law and free enterprise can do to any area. How many people remember that Namibia was the fifth province of South Africa? Namibia seceded from South Africa in 1990, and to be honest, they're doing better than we are. How can the Cape survive if it's independent? We've got a bigger economy and a bigger population in Namibia. Namibia is doing just fine. We will do even better. So we say, free the Cape. Cape exit. If the Soviet Union could do it, if all these other countries in Europe could do it, why can't we? But now I get the question, but what about Africa? Can it happen in Africa? Well, it's happened in Namibia, but it's happened in Eritrea, seceding from Ethiopia. But since 1995, I've been involved in the campaign for South Sudan's independence. From 1995 to 2002, I conducted 27 missions to Sudan during the heat of the war there, going way behind enemy lines in the Nuba Mountains, an island of Christianity, and a sea of Islam, under an Arabic government oppressing the black people of the south. They put a price on my head. Governor of Sudan actually published an article saying, Peter Hammond deserves to be shot on sight. He should expect to be bombed every time he comes to Sudan. His writings make him an enemy of the state. And I documented the bombing of churches, the bombing of marketplaces, the bombing of hospitals and schools. I experienced bombings. I took in film crews to be able to document the scorched earth, the destruction of the people of South Sudan at the hands of the colonial government of Sudan against the black Christians and animists of the south. We've been under fire. I've documented the destruction of churches, the crucifixion of pastors, the horrific atrocities done to men, women, and children over there. And we've delivered tons of food and medicines to the people. And behind the lines, we've seen what they're doing. I've calculated that I've personally delivered over 500,000 Bibles and books in 24 languages throughout South Sudan and Nuba Mountains. My son-in-law and other members of our mission have distributed something in the region of 340,000 more Bibles and books into Sudan and Nuba Mountains since then. Illegally, behind the lines, violating no-fly zones, you fly, you die mentalities. And so we worked with these people and we saw how much they were suffering. We saw their faith. These are different people, different culture, different language, different religion, different alphabet, different calendar from the government. Why should they be oppressed under a centralized government from Khartoum? And so we flew behind the lines, way behind the lines, and we delivered to them Bibles, books, medicines. That ambulance came all the way from Johannesburg up to Sudan. 5,000 kilometers by road. During this time, I conducted over 1,200 services and meetings inside Sudan, chaplain services, meeting with the soldiers, working with them at the battlefront, ministering behind the lines, establishing schools, hospitals, clinics, and we have many friends in Sudan to this day, including the Nuba Mountains, way behind the lines. This church was bombed 18 times in a 12-month period. 140 bomb crates around. And outside Sudan, I had over 1,000 meetings, radio and TV programs internationally to campaign for South Sudan's independence. We produced posters and maps and literature. And I wrote the book, Faith and Defiance Sudan, which went through three editions, the third edition being three times the size of the original edition, and documenting the needs, the atrocities, the history, the heritage. And while I never considered myself a camera person, I learned on the job, took a lot of video footage, which was some of the first images to get out of this hidden war, the hidden Holocaust, a forgotten people fighting a forgotten war. And so this film is interesting. It was filmed by an SATV war correspondent who was sent to Sudan to find me and do a hatchet job on me. And this war correspondent had been 23 years in the job working for SATV. He said, here's told by SATV, find Peter Hammond and do a hatchet job, destroy him. And he came and he was only with us for 3 days, but he produced a very positive film on it. And the reason is on day two, he was bombed with me in a church service in Sudan. Funny how one bombing can change your perspective. And he went from hostile to very positive, and SATV refused to screen it. I brought in filmmakers like Pat Matriciana of Jeremiah Films to produce Sudan, the Hidden Holocaust, and Terrorism and Persecution, and assisted Samaritan's Purse in bringing in their first hospitals and producing films on Sudan. Initially, even the leaders of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, the SPLA, they were skeptical that the map could ever be redrawn, as the African Union had resisted any changes to the borders delineated in the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885. I argued strenuously with Colonel John Garang, second person from the left there, and Commander Silver Kier, third person from the left, that only independence for South Sudan could secure their future and freedom. And they said, it's not possible. Not possible. They were convinced that the best they could hope for was autonomy. And I said, you will never be free unless you can be a majority in your own country. You'll be a persecuted minority in an Arab country unless you can break away as be a free black Christian South Sudan. And so I did the first redrawing of the map indicating South Sudan as a separate country from North Sudan. And, well, today that is the boundary. Anything else would mean the continuation of oppression by the Arab North. They'd be a minority in their own country. And although blacks are a majority in South Sudan, they're a minority in the whole country of Sudan. Missionaries at the time had pleaded with Great Britain, 1955, do not include black Christians and animists of the South into an Arab-ruled Sudan. It's a recipe for conflict. They suggested incorporate Equatoria into Kenya or Uganda if you don't want to make Equatoria its own country, but don't put them with people of a different culture, language, religion, calendar, and alphabet. From the very first day of independence, 1 January 1956, the Arab North sought to Arabize and Islamize the South with brutal oppression, great devastation, and loss of life. Millions and millions died. I showed from Sudan's history and from the teachings of Islam why the only way to be free of Sharia law and Arab oppression, which included chopping off of hands and crucifying of people and beheading and all that, was full independence and sovereignty of South Sudan and Nuba Mountains. Let each people rule themselves according to their own laws, not according to someone else's. And although they were highly skeptical that it was at all possible, today South Sudan is an independent country, internationally recognized. And Commander Silver Kier, who I'm standing next to in the middle here, he's become its first president since 9 July 2011. This picture was taken in 2001. 10 years before, he didn't believe it was possible for South Sudan to be free and independent. Today he's the president of South Sudan. Let my people go. That was the theme of the independence. All for separation. Indicating they voted. The stained finger. This is the polling station on whether they wanted separation or unity. And so they had two hands together for unity. They had one hand for separation. That was the vote, yes or no. And this is 9 July 2011. South Sudan independence. Here's war veterans who had lost their limbs in the war. The new South Sudan army and President Salva Kiir. Now, you may wonder about this cowboy hat. He visited Texas and he was on the farm, the ranch of George Bush, George W. Bush, president at the time. And he was given this hat and he's worn it like a crown ever since. And that's a new fashion. This Texas hat is very popular in South Sudan as a result. I don't know if you can see, but directly behind him is Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham of Samaritan's Purse. I personally recruited Franklin Graham in Cape Town at the town hall at a mayor's prayer breakfast when he was here in 1997 to speak on Newlands cricket grounds, to come to Sudan and open up a hospital because I knew his Samaritan's Purse could do it. And Franklin Graham sent the team and he was supporting them because he is a friend also of George W. Bush, who put pressure on the governor of Sudan to all these things work together. A picture is worth a thousand words. Raising the stumps of his hands in gratitude for the independence, to celebrate independence of the country. Some people gave a lot, and some gave all. From this day, our identity is Southern and African, not Arabic and Islamic. We are not worse Arabs, but better African. You can understand what they're saying. And so they've been celebrating the independence, and South Sudan is today unquestionably a free and independent country, separate from North Sudan, capital in Juba. Well, that's been a large part of my life, has been devoted to seeing South Sudan through to independence, and a huge amount of sacrifice and risks, and many, many, many people poured in heart and soul to see South Sudan being independent. It was a hard road. Today, we continue to campaign for freedom and independence for the Nuba Mountains, an island of Christian Sea of Islam up in northern Sudan. It's not part of the independent South. The Nuba Mountains is just north, and sadly, we're not included in the peace agreement in 2011. So they continue to fight. My son-in-law, Hunter, going north with other of our team members, continue to help schools. They've distributed hundreds of thousands of Bibles and books and textbooks and getting into the schools and ministering throughout the Nuba Mountains. Interestingly enough, the people there want English as their school language, not Arabic. That's one of the resistance to the government. And so we've got a whole lot of projects. And from Cape Town, we drive all the way up to Sudan. And the courageous Nuba Christians continue to resist the policies of the Khartoum government. Redrawing the map is absolutely essential to recognize ethno-linguistic demographic realities and to avoid further loss of life and future conflict. We must not continue to follow in the footsteps of failure. Centralization in a unitary state is as doomed to failure as the Tower of Babel. We all should remember the Tower of Babel being taught in the Bible. Notice the classic picture on the left, this painting by Brussels artist Bruegel. Then notice on the far right, the European Union Parliament in Strasbourg. Do you see any similarity? Well, just in case you missed it, notice in the middle, the EU produced this poster, Europe, many tongues, one voice. They deliberately built the EU Parliament as a replica of the Tower of Babel as depicted by the Brussels artist. And then they take the term where God judged the people for centralization with many tongues, and it says, many tongues, one voice. What they're saying, we're reversing Babel. It's basically rebellion to God, is it not? And I've been to the EU Parliament, and I've gone there to testify of what's going on in Sudan. We need to emulate examples of excellence, such as the decentralized model in Switzerland, the freest country in the world, with the most decentralization in the world. A country with the highest standard of living imaginable. This is their parliament. And it's a tough country. It's a mountainous country. It's a hard country. This is what their parliament looks like. This is a people's conference. They invented the referendum, and they gather together and let communities decide on the laws in their community. And the free enterprise model of Singapore, which is an example of excellence. The Berlin Conference, also known as the Congo Conference, sought to avoid conflict by recognizing European protectorates and colonies in Africa. Their goal, they said, was to eradicate slavery and the slave trade and to avoid conflict between European powers. And they were also gathered to seek to prevent rising American, Russian, and Japanese encroachments in Africa, which inevitably would have happened if Europe hadn't got involved. There's no doubt that the Americans, the Russians, the Japanese, and these days the Chinese are coming in great numbers. We either must rule and protect and preserve ourselves, or we will be colonized by others. And because we work in Zimbabwe, I can tell you Zimbabwe is being colonized by China right now. However, due to a lack of information and a very incomplete understanding of the realities of Africa, often borders were drawn along longitude, latitude, or utilizing a river. And the fact that tribes and nations lived on both sides of these arbitrary border markings were doubtless not realized at the time. So maps need to be redrawn. In my missionary work, it's been very clear. Maps need to be redrawn. Half the Shangaan people live in Mozambique and speak Portuguese. And the other half of the Shangaan live in South Africa and speak English. Half of the Vemba people live in Angola, where they learn Portuguese and drive on the right-hand side of the road, whereas the other half are in Southwest Africa and Namibia, learning Afrikaans, English, and driving on the left-hand side of the road. Moreover, they were in two different time zones, despite being north and south of one another. And the Tshewe people are divided between Malawi, Zambia, and Mozambique. And you could continue throughout Africa. The greatest conflicts in Africa, including the Biafran Civil War, 1967 to 1970, most of the Congo Wars, which have killed millions, and the conflicts in Sudan, they would have all been avoided if the maps had reflected demographic realities and not forced some people to be minorities in their own country, oppressed by their own, other tribes, cultures, or religions. And so this is why we say it's so important to redraw the map. And it's so important to recognize, can you even see down here, the Western Cape and Northern Cape are plainly delineated as distinctly different demographically from the rest of South Africa. Nigeria, oh my. The Nigerian Civil War was horrific. Now, I've spoken to people as survivors. Millions died in that conflict. It was unworkable. The Hausa, the Yoruba, the Igbo, they should have been given own countries. And so you can even see from the linguistic distributions in Africa and the different tribal groupings how maps need to reflect this. Or you need to go in a country like Switzerland where you've got many languages, cultures, and religions together. You need to have such decentralization that no one group is oppressed by another. Every group is ruling themselves in good neighborliness and good cooperation, because when a person don't have a say over their own future and their own communities and their own children's education, then there's conflict. And so there are realities. It's inexcusable that since independence, the Organization of African Unity has steadfastly refused to allow any maps to be redrawn. And so South Sudan and Eritrea's independence were very interesting and notable. This is the way the African Union would like things to stay forevermore. Political entities, not regarding ethno-linguistic or religious realities, but only thinking political. The apparent exception is Eritrea. But Eritrea was a separate entity before and was only forced after the Second World War to be part of Abyssinia, and they renamed that Ethiopia. After a very long-standing civil war, Eritrea's independence was re-established in 1991. So the redrawing of the maps and recognizing the independence of South Sudan was a monumentally important precedent. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war may arise against me, in this I will be confident. We are right down here at the southernmost tip of Africa, and we have a wonderful future ahead of us if we will seize it, if we will free the Cape. And if we look at the voting patterns by municipality, the Western Cape already votes differently from the rest of the country and therefore rejects what the centralized state is trying to impose upon us. And that is why we say we need to free the Cape, Cape Exit. Any questions? Questions? Comments?
Something that I come across a lot is that people are saying against the secession, yes, but it's going to be a bloody war, or there's going to be a lot of conflict. In your opinion, from your experience and all your travels, where do you gauge the potential of a peaceful, where do you rate in terms of peaceful and violent?
Well, the country's already very violent. Our municipalities are very violent. There's unacceptable crime levels that are worse than the death rate during the war. We lost more people in our country last year to murder than we lost on all sides of the war through 26 years of war on the border, just for example. So, yes, we've got to recognize we're already in war, and we've got a government that's declared war on us. They've already said they don't care about us. They don't care about our property rights. They don't care about the Bill of Rights. They want to take away land and give it to their people, obviously not us. And the way they act and talk, and they don't seem to care about how many people get murdered. So really, we're in a bit of a war anyway. But I believe, looking at things, we've passed the days when countries go to civil war over secession. If the secession is done legally, and in terms of referendums and clearly strong movements, it tends to be accepted. Now, just take, for example, Canada has had referendums on whether the French-speaking areas, Toronto and so on, could succeed. And if the majority had voted for it, Canada would have let them go. But the majority did not vote that way. Scotland had a referendum, and there was a lot of people in Britain were aghast. I mean, could Scotland be separate from England after 400 years? And if Scotland had voted a majority for it, England would have regretfully let them go. They wouldn't have fought over it. They were preparing for it, but the majority of Scottish people did not vote for it, although there was a lot who did. So I see the way things have been going, and the fact that you could have peaceful secessions in some countries gives us hope that maybe the day has passed when you could have a Lincoln saying we're going to war to preserve the Union. I don't think that we're at that state that any government will do it if the legal ways are followed. There's also the possibility that the present government may be happy to see the Western Cape go, because we are most of the opposition. We're a problem to them. And think what an increased majority controller would get in the rest of the country if they could get rid of the Cape. So there's possibility that we may be more trouble than we're worth in some of their minds. But it depends how it's done. Now, you know that there's a man in the Cape, R.W. Johnson, he's a British economist, who wrote on how long will South Africa survive. He wrote that back in the 1980s. And he wrote one recently as well, how long will South Africa survive. Now, his previous books, estimates, just looking from an economics, he predicted that by about 1994, South Africa would have to change completely. He's predicting that we are imminent at the dissolution and fracturing of South Africa. And his prediction is totally economic. When central government can no longer pay the bills, and when they can no longer keep the lights on, and they can no longer keep the water flowing, the country will break off, and he thinks the Western Cape will be the first to secede. And then he moved his family here, and he's living somewhere in the Table Bay area. So that's interesting, that he believes in our future enough to move here. I'm friends with Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi, and I can tell you the Kingdom of Zululand is moving towards secession as well. And the question is, will they be the first or will the Cape be the first? It's a bit of a race, because whoever goes first, the next will go second. And we're not the only ones. There's others talking about this too, talking about the Venda people and the Tswana and others. South Africa's 11 language groups. If central government was doing a great job and we were safe and the economy was great, we probably wouldn't be here today. But it's not working. And as a result, people are looking for solutions. And therefore, secession is one of the... I think centralization is always a bad idea. I think decentralization is always a good idea. And I've always liked the idea of Cape independence. But now, I no longer think it's a choice. I think it's just a matter of survival. As Des Palm said earlier, this is a matter of survival, economic survival for our children and our grandchildren. This isn't any more a matter of choice. A few decades ago, we could have sat and discussed and said, well, is this a good idea? Might it work? And there could have been merit to that. But right now, I think it's way past that. Now it's you go down with the Titanic or you launch out your own lifeboat. So no, I don't believe we'd be heading for war. I believe that the tactics of the Marxists would be EFF-type disruption on the ground, disruption, riots, terrorism, the solution to which would be taking the police and putting the police totally under the local municipality. The local municipality must own and pay and control and train the police, who must be answerable to the local municipality, which must be a real municipality. I'm not talking about the Unicity. We're talking about Tryfontein, Mitchell's Plain, each area, complete Athlone, ruling themselves. And the police come from your community, and they're answerable to your community, and they're paid by your community. Those police will not stand by while their uncle's shop is looted, and while their grandmother's home is stoned, and where their grandchilds are in danger. A police from that community will be highly motivated, and they'll know they've got the support of the community. But when you've got police from the other side of the country, speak another language, don't know, don't care, they can stand by and see everything looted. Because what's it to them? That's why a national police force is no good. We need municipal police forces with complete control in that municipality. So in a sense, what we're talking about is a confederation of microstates of the Cape of Good Hope, where each community is not under the other community. Now, we would have a national defense force. We would have to have district militias or groups and so on to deal with things that are beyond a municipality's needs. But most crime will be dealt with by municipalities having a no-tolerance view towards violent crime and destruction of lives and property. So I believe we could deal with that. Do you know how Brexit started? Brexit, which surprised a lot of people, started with the Queen making a speech, I think it was in 2016, where she said, we will deport from Britain any foreigner committing a crime within our borders. And the EU said, no, you can't do that. You cannot deport a foreigner from your area if he's a member of any other country within the EU. And the British people said, what? We can't choose to deport violent criminals who break our laws and our... And that's where Brexit got started, when they realized, you're trying to make our queen under some bureaucrats who never got elected in Brussels? No. And so Brexit was a runaway success, because even though all the mass media and the British government and the opposition parties all supported staying in the British, in the European Union and opposing Brexit, but Brexit won. Because the people on the ground had had enough. And by the way, social media won it for them, because the mass media was all against Brexit. Other questions?
I think it is a reality. People that still consider independence in the Western Cape, I think they must force themselves to have the reduction. It is a reality that people will be pushing for independence here in the Western Cape. Only the one question that I want to ask now, sir, doctor, is from your experience and the information that you have, is there any great challenges how the new government, was set up with these type of approach and implementation of independence?
You're talking about the new governments that we refer to?
No, I'm referring to, obviously, there will be new structures basically will be put in place. So,
yes.
So I'm talking about, or I'm referring to those structures. Can you maybe highlight some of those great challenges that have happened in those countries of independence?
Yes, of course, any new independent country must have an interim government. I think it's all laid out in your manifesto, roadmap to independence. You've got it laid out there, what needs to be done. The interim government will need to decide on the form, and it seems that all the states that I've been part of the independence of or witnessed, they've all chosen independence, they've all chosen decentralization, they've all chosen privatization, because they're sick of centralization and of the corruption that comes. Just think of the Unicity. Now, in my community, I used to know the mayor, know the town councillor. My daughter knew his sons. We knew where the mayor and the town council lived, and we could walk to our town council office and organize anything for building alterations, whatever. Now, the Unicity, corrupt, complicated, confused. My daughter and her sons just had to wait in the rain this week. 5 hours in the rain, only to be told when getting to the front, oh, waiting outside in the rain 5 hours, oh no, we can't deal with this until it's level one. But we phoned ahead, we made an appointment. Nobody told us this, and we explained. They don't care. They're not even polite. And this is what the Unicity is. But when the municipalities, you might remember when the municipalities were real municipalities, they actually worked. And I could also add that there was a time when the people in central government didn't get paid for being members of parliament, town councils, and so on. When I was at school in Rhodesia, in Bulawayo at Milton High, Mr. Rhys Davies was my history teacher, and he was a member of parliament. And I remember asking him, how can you be a member of parliament and also a school teacher? He says, we don't get paid for being members of parliament. We need a real job too. Now, that's the way it was. Now it's a get-rich-quick scheme for a bunch of professional parasites. So, yes, but it's up to the community to say, this has not worked, what's the solution? Which is why we're saying, look at Switzerland, look at Tiel, look at Singapore, and so on. And I think you've got in your manuals, you've got everything laid out there very well thought through. So, this is where we... there's a lot of countries in Europe think of getting out of the EU, and I've been showing you... Do you know who this is? This is the Orban, he's the Prime Minister of Hungary. Hungary's fed up with the EU, and Austria's also fed up with the EU, and France, this is the fastest growing party, the National Front. The Trump revolution, whether you agree with his policies or not, what's interesting is he won through social media. The mass media was totally against him. His own political party was against him. Every previous Republican president was against him, but a businessman won just because social media, the people were fed up, sick and sut of government policies as usual. So they elected a businessman, quite eccentric one too. Any other questions?
International interference assistance.
Yes. International. Of course, there's some people, in fact, I'm sure Des Palm could explain to you how there are groups out here who are putting all their hope for the independence of South Africa in a legal process where they're going to appeal to the United Nations. And there is not a snowball's chance in hell of the UN giving us anything. If we don't own our own future and make our own future and have a movement of our own people with our own referendum, the UN doesn't care about right or wrong, and they certainly don't care about us in the Cape. So interference from the international community, you can expect some. At least you can't expect any help from them. But that doesn't matter. We don't need them. We've got everything we need in the Western Cape, and if the government just gets off our back and they stop overtaxing us, we can have everything we need. Just think of how powerful a Cape could be if we became a tax haven, like Singapore and Hong Kong used to be, where they just attracted. Do you know at one time Hong Kong had a stronger economy than the whole of Red China? And the only reason why Red China's economy soared is because they amalgamated Hong Kong's economy since 1997. Hong Kong, a small, minuscule little place. What did they have going for them? Free enterprise and freedom of the press, which sadly is being threatened right now by Red China. But Hong Kong showed for a century what freedom can do. And Singapore is still showing us. So, yes, international interference, I'd expect some. But people have lost interest in international adventurism. And I don't think you're going to see a UN peacekeeping force coming like they did to the Congo when Katanga declared independence back in 1962. I don't think the day's over for that.
But on the other hand, we can rely on a lot of other international countries that will make this work.
I know of some countries already predisposed to support our claim for independence, and the moment we can do the legal steps towards it, there are countries ready now where we are in touch with leaders of major parties and major countries in Europe who will step in and support us. Yes. There's a question at the back. Lowered his hand, so over to you.
I don't know if you can answer it, but I'd like to know how far we are from the 1.6 million, you know, the target.
We're approaching half a million on the petitions.
Half a million. So, I mean,
we're getting there.
And I'm sure if everybody is here to leave, it's possible. Can happen, and this is the only way to go.
Yeah.
But also, I'm sure we're going to have a lot of resistance from internal government.
You're going to expect some resistance, but to be honest, this government's so incompetent, they can't even keep the lights on. So I would imagine that whatever they can do, they're so lazy and incompetent and they're so corrupt that I don't think they will be able to resist the will of the people of the Cape if we get organized and we stand up. We've had enough. I've marched 30,000 people to Parliament. I've seen, and the government was terrified. Cyril Ramaphosa came out in 1995 shivering and shaking with bloodshot eyes, sweating because of the fact that he was facing the biggest crowd Cape Town ever mobilized at that stage. I just suddenly realized I'm not plugged in. Does anyone have... We do have power here. Because, interestingly enough, we've got to be plugged in and we need to be switched on. Something that I think our government doesn't realize, but I don't know if you've also noticed that sometimes when you've got a problem, what do I need to do to get this word? There we go, great. Have you noticed how our government seems to work on how your IT tech support goes? Your computer's not working, try switching it off and then switching it on again. Switch off, switch on, and maybe it'll start working. Other question?
I want to know how are we going forward from here? How are we going to make this conference involved, this plane involved?
Yes. Yes. Well, I've got a handbook for Cape Independence on the table out there. You've all been given the roadmap to independence and the documents on Teal. You've got a lot in your hands. You've got the leaflets. You've got people to sign the petitions. That's where we start. Obviously, let's get the information out there. There's the website. There's the Cape Exit RSA Facebook page. There's the video we just saw today that you can share. So there's a whole lot of things we can do on social media. And if you aren't on social media, I recommend you get on it. But you've got in your packs leaflets you can distribute. You've got petitions you can sign. Yes.
Peter, I just want to answer that, right?
Yes.
I just think, to Eugene, if you want to organize house groups, otherwise small groups, and want us to come and talk with you, talk to them, sit around the table and discuss this, you are welcome to talk to us. And contact us and we'll come and help.
Yeah, community meetings are a great way. Another question back there? Your hand is up.
I'm going to follow up on this question that gentleman over there as well. So, in history, what was the biggest obstacles and how did they overcome it? Because now we've got social media and these
yes.
Back in those days, they didn't have social media.
Yes.
And what made them so successful and how can we utilize that success in the success of this one as well?
Those are the right questions. Yes. Good. So, plainly, word of mouth is key, and networks and communities and congregations and assemblies are all key. We've got to mobilize through the community groups that we've got, our friends and neighbors and even strangers and people at the shops. There's a lot of people. I find when I'm at the hairdresser, just talking about the problems and then talking about the solution of Cape Exit, wherever you are, whether you're the doctor, the dentist, there's so many ways, word of mouth, and you find people are more receptive since lockdown than ever before. Before lockdown, your numbers were about 80,000. You've grown over 400,000 in the petitions since the lockdown 6 months ago. So we've seen phenomenal growth. This is exponential. So plainly, people can now see the danger of centralized government. When they can tell you who can work, when you can work, how you can work, what time you can work, and show me your papers when you travel, that's not the kind of power we want for government. That's what they had in the Soviet Union. Do you know what Soviet means? Committee. And what have we got running the country right now? Not parliament. We've got a committee of six. The same number they had in the French Revolution. The Committee for Public Safety under Robespierre, who organized the guillotines. That's the first committee. The Soviet Union's union of committees. Government by committee. Right now we've got a committee of six who consult the ancestors, and all convinced Marxists ruling this country without regard to Parliament or our laws or even our Bill of Rights. This is unacceptable on every level. By the way, just to encourage people to say it can't be done, the day before the elections in 2016 in America, this is what the poll said, 98% chance Clinton winning, just over 1% chance of Trump winning. This is what they were saying at the time. And by the way, the newspapers, I don't know if you noticed, and these are all the Democrats who were all convinced of Hillary's winning. And this is the thing. They keep putting more and more power in the hands of a centralized president, not realizing what could happen if a president they don't like gets into power. Yeah. That's why decentralization is better, actually. And, yeah, this is the Clinton White House staff. Now you've got the cry bullies. This was the Cape Times, the day of the elections in America. Look at it. Wednesday, November the 9th of 2016. Hillary wins. But, in fact, she lost. And they said the same about Ronald Reagan. He had a 39% chance of winning in 1980, they said. And, well, he did win. So, don't listen to the pollsters. So, it doesn't matter what the mass media says. Remember who owns the mass media. We know our communities. We know our neighbors and our friends. We must use social media. What worked is following the law, doing things in a progressive way, as is laid out in the roadmap to Cape Independence, is following the law, building up support, so that this is not an illegal thing. We're not talking about revolution, coups. We're talking about referendum, legality, doing things in a good way, and having a plan for the future that it's going to work. So, you had a question, ma'am?
I have a question. The section of the question is a suggestion. With the upcoming elections, by us putting our mark next to the person that we would have voted for, would have voted, or in a limited choice scenario, we probably vote for whoever. Could we not? I don't know if this is the correct word. To me, it seems hypocritical for us to go forward in a poll where we actually don't want that ruling or that government elections. Why can't we just boycott it all?
I understand the question. Let me answer. In 1910, they were moving South Africa to a union of South Africa. And there was a whole lot of people who said, boycott this, we don't want a union of South Africa. So all that happened was, it was people who supported the British forced union of South Africa that had the say, who decided on the structure of South Africa, and all those who boycotted were just made voiceless. I know that there were at least 650,000 white South Africans who said, we won't vote in the 1994 election. So what did they achieve? Well, it just gave more votes to the ANC by stepping out, by not being involved. So the policy of boycotts when it comes to elections is self-defeating. It's counterproductive. We have municipal elections coming up next year, I think June or July, 2021, July, there we go, August. So we should be sure never to vote for a party that wants centralization, but a party that wants decentralization, autonomy, independence, who's open to a referendum for independence for the Cape. So let's investigate where parties stand. Let's put pressure on them. Let's persuade them. Already in the Cape, we are voting different from the rest of the country. So how much more easy is it for us to secede, because already the Capes never agreed to central government, ever. I mean, all of our history, the Capes had its own mind, and we are a different group of people. We have a different way of thinking. We're not like Joburg and Pretoria. So I think how we vote is critical, but boycott, definitely not. If you've got a voice, let's use that voice. You've got a vote, use that vote. And the municipal elections are key. Let's get people who are thinking our way who will speak up at the next municipal elections. Another question?
I would like to know what legal insurance you have regarding legal protest resulting in
arrest. At the moment, we all have a Bill of Rights, but this Bill of Rights has been ignored. Now, according to our High Court, the lockdown regulations are completely illegal, and they have null effect legally. No court's going to uphold them. So, you have a right to, according to the Bill of Rights, every law that violates this is no law at all and is invalid. You have a right to freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association, freedom of movement. All of these freedoms have been violated by the lockdown. And the High Court's declared it twice to be illegal, unconstitutional, of no effect. And yet they continue to do it. But if you go to court, the court will throw it out because it's got no power. But they're still intimidating us, but our government's operating illegally. It's not legal to have a state of emergency for more than 3 months, 3 weeks, and even then, no law can interfere with your basic Bill of Rights, such as freedom of worship, freedom of religion, freedom of movement, freedom of opinion, freedom of the press, and yet all these are being violated. So, plainly, you've got a right. You've got a right to protest peacefully at any time. Now, anything 15 and below is not a protest by definition. If you have over 15, you don't need permission. You need to notify the local municipality so that they can make provision if it might obstruct traffic and so on. Exception being Parliament. If you want to have a demonstration at Parliament, you need to get permission ahead of time, but they can't deny you permission. They can only try and find a town that won't interfere with, say, another demonstration, something like that. So you don't want the Israelis and the Palestinians marching at the same time to Parliament, for example. Wouldn't work. And so, plainly, we've got a right to protest peacefully. But interesting, this government stands back when people loot and burn and destroy, but then they use water cannon on restaurateurs and hospitality industry when they peacefully march. So this is not acceptable, and it's time we in the Cape just took our future back.